So the title I gave is Tangent Field Theory. So it's a bit of a cryptic title, but maybe it's not so cryptic after Richard's talk, because I will actually be working in that tangent space that he mentioned, where the field operators will be cotangent vectors in that on that manifold. But let me explain this. That the title I submitted, and the real title is that I'm trying to provide information theoretical foundations for quantum field theory, starting not from classical information theory, but from quantum information theory directly, and then try to understand what quantum field theory is from that. It's a joint work with Tobias Osborne, and this paper contains part of what I will talk about, at least the general framework. So what is quantum field theory? So the idea of quantum field theory is, in principle, to have a local quantum theory in the continuum, meaning that there should be independent quantum degrees of freedom at every point in space in the whole in the continuum. So I want to explain a few things about the continuum first before I go to, I get further. So as an example of continuum structure, of continuous structure, let's look at this font. If we zoom on the font, on any part of the font, at some point it gets boring. It always gets to a straight line. And the reason for this is that it's a vector font. It is defined as a solution for a differential equation at each point. And because it is a solution of an equation that involves derivative, it has to be differentiable and therefore boring at some scale. Now, the reason why this is okay to do classical physics in this way is that at the end of the day, we always use finite resolution instrument to measure things. So it's okay if our description is boring at some scale. But the point of a continuous description is that it works for arbitrary finite resolution. So it doesn't matter, you're going to have finite resolution, but it doesn't matter what it is. It will work no matter how precise the measurements are, but not infinitely precise. In fact, if I had to zoom from a corner of the font, then it could have taken me a much longer time, zooming time, until it becomes boring because I was close to the corner. Now, a continuum system does not need to be smooth. It does not mean to be differentiable. There are ways to define continuous curves which are not differentiable. And the way it's done in general is that for every possible resolution, you have to specify a description which is good enough for that resolution. As an example, I can define a fractal curve that is not differentiable but continuous. And one way to do this, and the way it's usually done, is by not giving a different equation, but giving a sequence of description and an algorithm to generate an infinite sequence, such that for a given resolution, at some point you can stop and it's good enough for your resolution. So in that case, if I went to the next step, so I guess you guess what the rule is, right? You take one segment and you divide it into four new segments, and then each new segment is divided again, and so on. So you know how to generate an infinite sequence. But I can stop here because the resolution of this projector is finite. And if I went one step further, you will not see the difference from this one. So here I can stop here. But if you had a higher resolution, then you will need to go a few steps further. Now, this is no different from the way that real numbers are defined. So there are two ways to define real numbers. You can do it axiomatically in terms of algebraic properties, but I will not talk about this. The more constructive way is to specify real numbers as a sequence of rational numbers that converges in some sense, which is exactly the same idea. More precisely, a real number is a sequence of rational, which is Cauchy, which means that no matter what your experimental resolution is, epsilon, then if you go far enough in the sequence, you're not able to distinguish two points in the sequence anymore, given that finite resolution. Now, I will argue that to define a field state, one should do something similar. That is, the field state should be specified by a sequence of regularized field states in some Hilbert space as a function of some regulator, let's call it lambda, that could be an energy cutoff or lattice scale. And this sequence should define a continuous field if it is convergent in some sense. And the sense would be that no matter what your which it could be more than one parameter. It could be because everything you measure will need some kind of finite resolution. So sigma could be a spatial resolution, for instance. Then no matter what your setup is, if you go far enough in the sequence, there's a point where two of the fields are not distinguishable anymore in that sequence. Okay. And it turns out that such a sequence of field is what is called a Realmutation group trajectory in quantum field theory. Or at least that's my argument. That's why in quantum field theory, a state is not specified by just one point in a Hilbert space, but by the sequence of states that in some sense converges to the true state we are trying to describe. And this also allows me to argue that whenever one defines quantum field theory, one needs some kind of measure of distinguishability, an effective measure of distinguishability to at the very core of the theory to define it, as well as some kind of randomization. So I'm going to, so most of the talk will be about simplifying this sentence to get to a point where it's kind of approximate, but where it matches what is actually done in quantum field theory. And first, I want to focus on this measure of distinguishability and try to define this. So here's an example of a measure of statistical distinguishability, which is a trace distance. Like any measure of distinguishability, it is given by some optimization of effects for a probability between two states. So A here is, so it's a maximum over a set of all possible effects, which really belong to your POVM, which is implicit here. And the reason is that we are trying to find the best measurement that will allow us to distinguish the two states, and we find the best, the smallest probability. Now, such a measure of distance only knows about statistical distinguishability. It cannot tell apart, you know, if you have two orthogonal states, say, representing a particle on a line, it cannot tell how far those particles are. It can only tell how distinguishable they are if they are spread. Now, this assumes that you have access to all possible observables. But in practice, you only have access to some observables, those that have some, because you have exponential limitations. This could be finite resolution or finite energy in your setup. So we want to be more accurate, we want to do this over some POVM. Now, in general, you know, if we choose some weird set of effects here, we will have to redo the whole optimization, which will be very difficult. So instead, I'm going to look at a set of effects which are defined as being in the image of a channel in the Heisenberg picture. So in this way, this is a completely positive map that is unital. And in this way, the maximization is again over all effects. And simply n will implement the kind of uncertainty limitation, exponential limitations I have. The reason I do this is that then I can go to the Schoenegger picture, use a dual on the states, and now it's exact same optimization as I did before on some coarse-grained states under the channel. And so I can just use the same measure I had before, but acted on the coarse-grained states. Right? So that's easy. You can do it for any measure, so you can take your preferred measure of distinguishability, trace distance, relative entropy, or fidelity, and simply coarse-grain it with a channel, and this amounts to the more realistic experimental distinguishability. So concretely, what will happen is that the channel will implement, will array the information up to the, to some, well, as an example, for instance, you could, and could array the information up to a scale sigma, which amounts to assuming that you only have, you can only do measurements with finite resolution sigma, and then I will get a measure that depends on sigma. Something important to realize that this measure knows now only, also knows, well, it knows about statistical distinguishability, but it knows more. Now it knows about distance in space. Because if you if now you have two states that are orthogonal in the position line, but you coarse grain them a bit, they will start to overlap, and then this will actually know how far they are on the line, even though they are orthogonal in terms of the pure distinguishability. So it's a measure that combines statistical distinguishability and physical distances, a bit like the Monge metric, if you are familiar with it. Now, I'm going to have to simplify things, so I will not use, so the kind of distance I will use is one which can be reached from an infinitesimal variations. So if you have any measure of distance, you could look at distance between two neighboring density matrices, where epsilon is a small number and x is a difference of states. And I want a metric which suggests that this to lowest order is to order epsilon square in this vector x. I will write this as a binary form that depends on a point rho. So sometimes I write it as a norm squared in terms of this binary form. And of course, this this vector x is a tangent vector to the manifold of states. So that's what I'm doing. I'm working in tangent vector at a point rho of the manifold of mixed states and or pure states. And I have a metric, I have a binary form at each point, which is a Riemannian metric on the manifold of states. The only condition on this operator x, as long as rho is not on the boundary, is that they have to be self-adjoint and traceless. So that's what I just wrote. And of course, I want to look at the coarse-grained version of that through the Chandler N full to get the concrete distance that I care about. So I just, you know, this is how the norm of the tangent vector x will look like in the coarse-grained norm. The point has to change as well as the tangent vectors. The reason I apply N to both is that because N is linear, the push forward is N itself. Now, you could, if you try to go the other way, you could take the manifold of state and equipe it with any Riemannian metric you want. But if you ask that the Riemannian metric is measure some kind of distinguishability or operational meaning, then it has to decrease whenever you coarse grain. It has to contract because clearly if I have less pure VM to optimize over, then things become less distinguishable. This doesn't look like a too strong a condition, but actually it's very strong because classically, if everything commutes, then it selects one single metric, which is the Fisher information metric, which has this form. Here you see the 1/rho of the states. Quantum mechanically, there's a set of them. They have all been characterized by Dennis Petz. So for what I will do next, I could use any of these metrics, but I will focus, for instance, on one of them, which is the Beers metric, which has this form. So this linear map on operator, which defines the metric itself, so the kernel, is the inverse of this operation, which is just a non-commutative form of multiplication by rho. So if they commute, it was classical, then this would be 1/rho, just like the classical case. You may have seen this this metric in the quantum Kramer-Hauer bound, where if you're a family of density matrices parameterized by parameter theta, and you want an observable that will estimate the parameter theta, then the error, the fluctuations will be bounded below by 1/ the norm of the derivative of this parameterized state in that metric. Okay, so now this is kind of the core of the talk, and this is a method by which I will somehow simplify this Cauchy condition I had before. So let's look at the block. So I have this channel N, right, which coarse grain the system. It's not a real channel, it does not really happen. There's no real communication, it's just an artifact of limiting the observable. But for this picture, it will be useful to think of it as a channel between Alice and Bob. So here's a portion of Alice's state. It has a shape because there's a metric on it. And the channel will contract it, maybe more in some direction and less in other direction. Now, the idea is that the observer is trying to, so Bob is the observer and is trying to distinguish, he can only make any measurement in this manifold of states, and he's trying to distinguish states on Alice's manifold from the information he has on his little copy of the manifold. Now, you know, Bob will have some, will make a limited number of experiments, so we'll have some fundamental uncertainty on how much he can distinguish states, which will be some kind of little epsilon balls on his manifold. So this represents the smallest neighboring the set of states he can actually not distinguish. So any state within one ball are states that he can effectively not tell apart for sure. But he doesn't care about this manifold of states. This is just virtual. He cares about this manifold of states. And so the pre-image of the balls are typically pancakes. They will be very spread in a direction that contracts the most. So what this means is that the meaning of this pancake is that they correspond to many to set of states that Bob cannot effectively distinguish with his measurements, which are essentially equivalent from his point of view of making predictions and of making theories of. Right? So his role, if he only has access to this kind of measurement, his role is to, in doing physics, in describing the state, is to label in which of the pancakes the true state is. He cannot do better than that. Now, this description is a bit annoying because these pancakes, they overlap. They don't define equivalence classes. I want to compress them into crepes, which are much more tasty because they are infinitely thin and infinitely large in the other direction. And no, they don't overlap, and they define real equivalence classes. And that allows me then to look at these, if you wish. It gives me easy ways to label them. I want to do geometry, so I'm going to simplify things. I'm going to linearize things by looking at picking a point in the manifold and looking at what happens in the tangent space at that point, that everything is linear, and I don't have weird curvature, but these will actually be flat planes. So the quantity of interest is a contraction ratio in a given direction. So x is a tangent vector at a given point in Alice's manifold, and I care about how much information I lose because of the channel. That is a quantity that is independent of any kind of parameterization of your problem. And if I want to find the direction of these pancakes, of these crepes, what I will need to do is to maximize this over x. If I do this, I will find the direction that contracts the least, which is the one that is the most relevant for my description. So in that example, the largest one will be the one in that direction, which is the one that contracts the least, which has the largest eta. Yeah. Well, no, this is not. So this is not a channel. So think, for instance, of the relative entropy distance. So if Bob can make only a finite number of experiments, then there will always be an error at which he cannot distinguish a state. So the relative entropy will be the exponent in the error as a function of the number of repetition of the experiment. So if he has a finite number of experiments, then he won't be able to fully distinguish the states. There will always be some limit. But you will see later, it will be more concrete later what happened. What happened is that n will depend on a parameter, a scale parameter, and we'll care about the asymptotic as function of the scale parameter. Now, so I could look for the largest, for the x that maximizes this, which is the most important one, and then look at the orthogonal subspace and again do a maximization and so on. But this is equivalent to doing an eigenvalue problem, solving an eigenvalue problem, or in fact, it's equivalent to looking at doing the singular value decomposition of the channel n with respect to the metric. Or you can write it as an eigenvalue equation. So n is my channel, and star rho is the adjoint of n with respect to the metric, and because the metric, which is a scalar product defined by the metric, and because the scalar product depends on point rho, the nature of the adjoint depends on the point rho as well. This is where the problem becomes dependent on the point in the manifold where I am. And so I can solve this eigenvalue problem, and I know that these eigenvalues are between 1 and 0, and I can order them and keep the first few, which are the more important one, and try to neglect the smaller ones. Yeah, so here I'm describing things, think finite dimension for now. Yeah. These things can be extended to infinite dimension, and I will not go into the details, but trust me for now, and we can talk about later how this maps to the infinite dimensional cases, but there's no real problem here. It goes pretty nicely. That's what I want to do. And then how does the reduced theory look like, or the reduced notion of distinguishability, is that if I have two perturbations around the state rho, so x are some tangent vectors that I imagine small, I remove the epsilon just for the sake of clarity here. Then in this crepe-like approximation, I will say that two of these states are effectively indistinguishable if the difference vector x minus x prime is in one of the directions that contract the least, which is the same as saying that it is orthogonal to all those directions that contract the most, which is what I wrote here. And eta I is, so these are the eigenvectors, and eta I is the rate of contraction of the eigenvector xi. Now, there's a much more physically intuitive way of rewriting this. So these are the form of a trace of x minus x prime against some operator, which is these operators. So it's the same as saying that those two states are effectively indistinguishable if they yield the same efficient values for some observables AI, which are actually just the cotangent vectors corresponding to the tangent vectors XI. Because this is contracting the metric with the tangent vector, so you get a cotangent vectors. And a cotangent vector is kind of an observable because it's meant to be contracted with a tangent vector to give a number. And a tangent vector is just a difference of states, so that's really an observable. And instead of finding the XI directly and then computing the AIs, you can find the AIs directly from the dual eigenvalue problem, which is a kind of the Heisenberg picture version of what I had before. This dagger is the adjunct with respect to the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, whereas this star is the adjunct with respect to the metric. So that's the key, right? So I'm given a state, a point in the manifold, and a channel n, which represents my coarse graining, and I want to solve this eigenvalue problem, and then I'm going to keep only the AI with a larger eta I, which I call those my relevant observables or my effective observables, those that I can effectively measure in a sense. So I'm kind of reducing my algebra of observables in some sense.
So this is the process of making the crep, making it into a crep?
Yeah, that's the flattening of the crep.
And so the crep could be a low dimension. It's not necessarily cotangent.
It's not necessarily what?
The dimension is determined by epsilon.
The dimension is determined by how many of those terms you're going to keep. And this is depend really on the asymptotic as a function of, so the channel will depend on some parameters. And I will look at each eta will have different asymptotical behavior. And then you can choose which asymptotic you want to keep. Okay, so these are my crepe. And so at the end of the day, if what you want is to label them by a single point. So one way of doing this is to have a manifold of effective state nodes that just crosses my crepe in only one point. And these will be my effective states. So as an example to illustrate this, one way of doing this will be, suppose I write my state rho at which I did this derivation as a Tamal state in terms of some Hamiltonian, and these are my relevant observables, the one that contracts the least. Then remember that two states are effectively equivalent if they yield the same efficient values for these observables. So one way of selecting a single state for any set of expression value of the observable is to ask for the one that minimizes the relative entropy to rho itself. And this problem is well known, and the solution is Gibbs states, right? Where it just corresponds to adding linear combination of these operators inside the Hamiltonian. That's one way of doing it, it's more of an illustration. So this will select a unique state here. A manifold of that type, at least in the neighborhood of rho. So let me now use this to show how you can apply this to a spin system, and then the relevant observables will be essentially field observables. So I'm going to take the simplest possible spin system. So I have to do things around a given state, so I'm going to do things around that state, just a product state. So here I write it in one dimension, but it could be any dimension. And for the channel, so the channel is a bit more complicated. This channel is not motivated by simplicity of calculation. It's motivated by it being pretty realistic. And it's composed of two terms, one term parameters by y and one term parameters by sigma. So the y term is just independent depolarization at each site, parameters by y, in such a way that you can think of y as the precision at which you measure spin values at each point. So you have a limiting precision on the spin value, which is kind of important. And the other part is generated by a Lindblad operator, which has this form. What it does is it's a sum of all neighboring pair of sites on the lattice, and these are swaps of the two sites. So what this does when you start integrating it is that it swaps neighbors, and it creates a sort of diffusion of the lattice and erases small scale information. One way to see this is that if you apply it to an operator acting at one single site I, you can solve a different equation, and this is just a diffusion on the sites. So you are trying to measure A at the site I, but actually what you are measuring is you're not really sure at which site you are measuring according to a Gaussian distribution of probabilities.
Or the operator, or just
Which one is this? Yeah, it's a swap procedure. Sorry? Well, so rho is a matrix on a pointer, and L of rho is a linear map on operators. It's a Lindblad generator. So it generates a transformations on the space of matrices. So here it looks like I'm doing one after the other, but actually you could write this in terms of a generator as well. And these generators commute. So you could really do it, you know, do them at the same time continuously. So it's kind of losing function on both as a function on, I mean, Y could be a function of sigma, and then you could do them continuously, remove both information at the same time. Yeah, you could have just a single, you could write it in terms of a generator, but then Y would have to be a function of sigma, and then you would have a sigma-dependent full generator that generates the whole channel. But I like to be able to keep them independent. That is, you know, that's my spin precision and my scale precision. Also, there are many contexts where it's natural to scale one as a function of the other. Okay, so now I just have, I have all the data. I just need to solve my eigenvalue equation to see what I can neglect. So I remind you that this is kind of the contraction ratio. The first step is to realize that because rho is pure, the this norm is actually infinite whenever x is not in a pure direction. Meaning, in a, being in a pure direction, it has this form, whereas this was my state rho is this way. Which means that, but this guy is always finite because n removes enough information to make rho mixed. So any vector which is not in a pure direction, I can neglect because it contracts infinitely. That's my first step. Yeah, so you know, this standard vector is a pure standard vector which has this form in pure states. And A, in fact, I can write this in this way. A is a cotangent vector, and X is a tangent vector corresponding to A, because this is, again, the inverse matrix, so I'm contracting the cotangent vector with the inverse matrix, tangent vectors. So I know I just label the tangent vector. Now I can label every tangent vector by a cotangent one. Because rho is not invertible, in fact, not every tangent vector has a cotangent vector, but the inverse is true. And the shape of the metric in terms of this type of tangent vector is just the correlator of the covariance in terms of the cotangent vector. So it has a very simple form. In fact, in some of the talks this week, you've seen sometimes a covariance thing being used to measure some kind of distance. Then you could reinterpret it as, if you want, as a Fisher information metric. Okay, so now the next, so we've already eliminated all a certain number of directions on the tangent space. Now the next step is to think about the spin value precision. So I won't show the details here, but you can pretty easily show that if the cotangent operator is the observer corresponding to a tangent vector X is acting, is less than n local, acting on more than n site non-trivially, then it contracts at a rate of the form y to the minus n, where y again is the spin value precision, and n is a number, is a non-locality of the operator A. And this can be extended to any linear combination of these operators. What this means is that, for instance, in the extreme case where y is very, very large, and I'm very inaccurate in measuring spin value, then maybe then the most relevant things I can measure are the observables which act on only one site, or linear combination of those. That's the first step. And then if you look at the, so I know how the channel acts on those guys, it just diffuses single site operators. So the channel is diagonal in momentum space. So then the full solutions of the eigenvectors, the most relevant eigenvectors are of this form. They're just, so tau x and tau y are spin Pauli matrices acting at the site j. And these are just with spin waves operator. And they are the eigen operator with eigen values which behave in this way. What this means is that as soon as the momentum is larger than one over sigma, which sigma was the scale of the precision in space, then I can neglect. So there's a natural cutoff coming in. Now, I want to call those field operators. The reason is that it's more clear that I can call them this way if I allow myself now to have infinite spin precision. So I will allow this to have an asymptotic to any power in Y. If I do this, then one can show that that the eigenvectors are, well, it's not entirely true, but anything which is orthogonal to observables of this form, product of those field operators, are irrelevant. So the contraction ratio goes exponentially well in K. So these are my relevant observables. So here I just wrote phi, but you could put any pi and any of the conjugate fields in there. So why do I call those conjugate fields? Is because remember that they're not really observables, they are Cartesian vectors. And this on my tangent space is equipped with a natural topology given by the scalar product, which is defined by the metric. And if I complete this tangent space, Cartesian space, then I'm left with an algebra where phi and the pi I defined before satisfy the canonical commutation relation. This is just the central limit theorem, but reformulated in this framework. So these are field operators, and they are the relevant one, and they have relevance to that order. So it means that the relevant one really is the one which have a cutoff on the momentum. So this is how I get a bosonic quantum filtery from this framework. Now, let me give you another example of the same framework applied to a different in a different context. The goal is to understand the perturbative quantum filtery. So, in perturbative quantum filtery, let me first explain how the Remschen group comes naturally in this framework. So, I just want to rewrite what I wrote in the beginning. Right, in the beginning, I had a condition on a sequence of regularized states for it to be converging to a field. So I was saying, condition for it to be Cauchy. Now I have a new condition which is simplified in this framework using this approximation of mapping the pancakes to crepes. And it goes this way. So here I take the example where my channel, my coarse grating has only one parameter, which is spatial resolution for as an example. So I will say that this sequence of regular states is convergent if Cauchy, if whenever I go far enough in the sequence, then these efficient values become independent of lambda of the regulator, where these guys are my relevant observables, meaning they are solutions of my eigenvalue equation. But now I follow, it's non-perturbative. I came out of a tangent space, and I'm following, moving from one tangent space to the next to keep the conditions alive and keep going orthogonal to the crepe. I want to keep inside a crepe. So, but I get a different crepe at every point in space. So that gives me the differential equation. And it's nice that we have an equality instead of, the main point of the approximation could be understood as saying that no, I have an equality instead of an inequality, which is much easier to deal with. So this is kind of a generalized RG equation coming from this theory. So let me explain what it does to, first graphically. So before I say that, if this is my crepe of indistinguishable states, I wanted a manifold of F3 which cuts them at only one point. But what I have now is a manifold that cuts them at one dimensional submanifold. And it has two parameters. It has a real alpha parameter, which could be a coupling constant, which I care about. And it has this regulator, which I don't care about. My prediction should not depend on this regulator, which means that my RG trajectories are these intersection lines. And this is what the equation is figuring out.
What is the dimensionality of this effective manifold?
So everything is, so all of them are continuously infinite dimensional. Because they are labeled by the momentum k, which are continuous.
But in general, there could be, the only thing is that it's just co-dimension term in the cell. When you do parameterization and regularization, the only thing you know about dimensionality is that you have co-dimensional.
Is it the case, or is it just that the intersection is one-dimensional? I think that's more. Let me just show what this looks like in perturbative QFT, meaning that we are looking at a Gaussian state and the neighborhood of a Gaussian state. So I'm using an example where I have a Gaussian. So actually, you can solve the eigenvalue equation for any Gaussian state and any Gaussian channel in general. But here, I take the example of a Klein-Gordon field. And the channel has this form. It's a Gaussian channel. So it's defined what it does to Weyl operators, and it's defined in terms of two operators, x and y, which are operator on the classical phase space, on the classical field phase space. And what they do is x, it takes a convolution of the field with a Gaussian, which means that it erases everything up to a given scale, sigma in space. So again, it has two parameters, sigma, which is a spatial resolution, and it has another parameter, y, well, y phi and y pi, which are the precision at which I measure local speed field value, which could be different for different fields. Now, in that case, one can solve the eigenvalue problem, and I again get that the field operators and product of the field operators are actually exact eigenvectors of my eigenvalue equation, so there's a relevant one, and these are how much they contract. The important point here is that you get this exponential factor which suppresses high momenta, so it gives a natural cutoff. And you know, if at the end of the day, if you don't care too much about the value, the precision at which you measure local speed value, but only about the precision at which you measure a spatial scale, then what the RG condition I wrote before boils down is that the derivative of endpoint function for with a momentum cutoff should be independent of the regulator parameter lambda. Now, this is clearly true in the tangent space at the Gaussian state, but if you start doing perturbation theory away from the Gaussian state, these eigenvector becomes dressed up to any order in perturbation theory. However, because you don't care about how many, because you don't care about the spin value precision, you don't care about how many there are in the product, and therefore it boils down at the end of the day to the same condition, even when you do it perturbatively. And of course, I mean here, you know, any, including the canonical conjugates as well. And I'll stop here.
So I'm just wondering, you're mixing information geometry in with spatial geometry in this renormalization procedure.
Not true.
Well, it's not true. Okay.
Well, no, sorry.
So I'm just wondering, what do we gain relative to the way? Is there some? Are there some new insights relative to the way it's usually done, or some better tools? Or
So here, I've, you know, this is how it's usually done. So it's boring, but that's kind of the point: is to show that, you know, how I got to this boring stage, using arguments which are different than normal arguments. Mm-hmm. But now, now we have the whole, you know, whole way of going there, and we can start modifying going there. So for instance, you can start modifying the channel that you use, or you can start modifying the, for instance, now you might start to care about the field value precision. And if you do this, then your effective theory will have a cut of a fixed number of products. You cannot only see product up to a given n, and if it's interacting theory done perturbatively, then this will be non-trivial dressed field operators that you can compute, and you will get non-trivial conditions which are different from what you would normally do. Also, it could give you a justification for why, for instance, Gaussian theories are good, because they correspond to the cases where you can only have go to n equal 2, which is the case where, which is good if you have very high field value imprecision. So that's the type of question you can start asking. Also, you could, on the case of the spin system, now you can, it gives a very precise route to derive an effective field theory from a spin system. And so you could start from some interacting spin system, and maybe numerically, they start from an MPS, numerically derive what these effective fields are, and there will be some non-trivial fields which are dressed and do not necessarily fork a force space. You might get, we might try to derive numerically, for instance, the fusion rules of the effective CFT that you get from this type of approach.
That's probably a quite stupid question. What is the equation for the Cauchy condition for the renormalization flow? Is D over D lambda should go to zero as lambda goes to infinity?
Yeah. Oh, this one or the more precise one in the beginning? So this is the approximated one, and I had the kind of the more correct one, if you wish.
Okay, sure. I mean, that I know. I mean, that. But the other one, then you had the derivative, and it, why was it then equal to zero, not only approximately equal to zero? Or what is
it? Yes, it has to do with my pancakes being nomad to crepes. So what this means is that as a function of the regulator lambda, my sequence of state has to move within one of the crepe, because the crepe corresponds to my exactly indistinguishable state. So the true condition should be that it should kind of converge to a crepe if you wish.
Yes.
But this is just a thing that it should be inside the crepe, exactly inside the crepe.
Oh, yes. Could you tell more about this completion of the tangent space, the topology of the metric, and what you get by it?
So I don't know if you're familiar with the central limit theorem, the quantum
version.
Yeah. So if you look at these operators, their commutator is not the identity. It has correction, which goes as, so first of all, the 1 over square root 10 is coming from the fact that they are normalized in the metric. The commutator has a term that scale faster as a function of n. So they're not exact bosonic operator, but if you take now n to infinity, in this topology, you can take the limit n goes to infinity, and in that limit, these have bosonic commutation.
But this what you get as a completion is what is a hyperspace or?
Yeah, it's a hyperspace. It's basically the it's a GNS-like construction.
So this product is written. Louder, okay. So this product is written in this hyperspace, yes.
I should be a bit more careful. So to be precise, here the product is just the operator product on the spin lattice, the microscopic product. But what happens is that once you complete, you converge to an actual bosonic algebra,
okay.
Where the correspondence is.
And then you represent it in this hyperspace.
Yes, then you can.
Should we thank the speaker again?